So Robichaud, the batter.
Base hit down the right field line. This could score two. Davis is around third. He's going to score. The ball gets away from Duvall, and Simeon's going to come in to score. And the Blue Jays have tied. Robichaud once again comes up with a big hit. Marte in deep left center, and that'll be it. Vladdy Guerrero comes in, and what a dramatic comeback for the Blue Jays. They win it 6-5.
Hey, it's At the Letters, presented by Miller Lite, the original light beer. Today is Thursday, June the 3rd. My name is Arden Zwelling. Ben Nicholson-Smith is with me, as always, and our producers, as usual, Christian Ryan and Mike Tassoni. Thanks for everything that they do. Ben, it's kind of nice that we do this once a week, because it kind of does give you this like interesting macro look at the club. Because, you know, as if you'll remember, last time we did this, like, the sky was falling in Blue Jays land. Like, they lost, you know, six in a row, and it was, oh, what's going on? And they were losing heartbreakers, and, you know, everybody was freaking out. And since then, the club's gone 6-2, and nobody's panicked anymore. And they're 29-25 and four games above 500. So it is nice to get this weekly perspective to know that six-game losing streak isn't quite as bad as it feels in the moment.
Right, and it is such a long season, even now. So they're 54 games in as we record this, exactly one-third of the way through the season. And like you said, they have 29 wins. So that puts them on an 87-win pace over the course of 162, which is more or less what both you and I predicted as the season was beginning. We thought this is a team that could be in the upper 80s as far as wins, and here they are. It's not, of course, the way that we thought that they would get here, and it never is. We certainly know that at this point, but they're roughly where we thought they would be, with a chance to be better as things move ahead. And like you said, things are in a better spot for them now than they were a week ago.
Yeah, 87 win pace feels about right. Like, I would say this team has played to its talent and played to its potential. They've had a very hard schedule. They've had some challenges other clubs haven't had, obviously, of playing in Dunedin and upheaval and now moving homes and all of these things. But yeah, I mean, four games over 500, 87 win pace, you know, where's the run differential right now? Plus 47. That feels about right. And you know what, Ben? That's not going to be good enough. Not in the American League East. It's not the AL Central. I mean, this is a club that, like, it reminds me of, like, the Blue Jays teams that, like, I grew up with in, like, 06, 07, 08. You know, like, those clubs that would routinely win, like, 86, 87, 88 games a season and finish in fourth in the American League East without a prayer of reaching the postseason. Like, good clubs, above 500 clubs, positive run differential clubs, but not good enough in this absolute meat grinder of a division. Because for, you know, as many positives as there have been for the Blue Jays, and for as well as they're playing and better than like so many other MLB teams, they're still looking up at the Yankees and looking up at the Red Sox and especially looking up at the Rays in this division. 87, 88 wins, it's not going to be good enough for this team. They're going to have to outperform that over the next couple thirds of the season.
No doubt. Yeah, I think they will have to, not necessarily by a ton, but I think you want to be closer to 90, 92. And I think that they can. I think when you get Springer back eventually at some point, not sure exactly when that's going to happen still. Let's say even it's for half of the season, that's a big addition to have on this team. Then, of course, you have some returning arms potentially. Trade deadline coming up. I still think the Jays add. So his schedule will play in their favor. So I think that they should be in a better spot. But like you said, this division's really tough. I mean, the Rays already are playing some great baseball. Rich Hill looks like a great pickup for them. Like, they just somehow move on from trading Blake Snell, losing Charlie Morton, and they don't miss a beat. It's actually incredible. And I guarantee not even Kevin Cash and Eric Neander would have predicted that Rich Hill would basically be an ace starter 2 months into the season, but they'll take it, and they've got Wander Franco coming, and that's going to be a force of a player in this division for the next 4.5 years until they trade him. So it's going to be a tough division from here on out. And I think the Yankees and Red Sox, even if they're not quite to the level of those, you know, 06 to 08 era teams, where those teams were kind of on a different tier than the Jays almost, certainly with respect to payroll, I would say also with respect to talent, there's probably a smaller gap. And you could argue, I would say the Jays are better than the Red Sox, somewhat close to the Yankees when it comes to talent in 2021, but there are four good teams now in the East instead of three. So it's just, it really is a challenge in this division.
Yeah, I remember seeing it coming into this season. Like, why is everybody doing their annual exercise and sleeping on the Rays? Yeah. Why would you do that? The Rays are such a problem. They're such a problem. They're good now. They play well now. They like have had the Blue Jays number for quite a while. And they're going to be really good tomorrow because they have a sick system and like incredible development. And they just nail player acquisition through international free agency, through the amateur draft, and they bring in players and they develop them and they turn them into really productive big leaguers, and they build rosters really, really well, and they make really smart moves as well, right? Like, you look at them like jumping the market to pull off a trade to acquire two relievers a couple weeks ago. I mean, you know, who saw that coming, right? For, you know, with Willy Adames being traded. But you can do that when at AAA you've got like three young shortstops coming up who all look good and can all fill in on your major league roster. So yeah, I mean, so what gives you confidence, I guess, that the Blue Jays can outperform, you know, what they've done so far over, you know, the final two-thirds of the season here? Like, how do you think they get that done?
Well, I think Vlad Jr. is a big part of it, and every week Vlad Jr. continues to show us that he is one of the best hitters in baseball.
For Vladdy Guerrero Jr., Vladdy doubled his first time up. Yep. Goes after the first pitch and hits it high. Seen two pitches tonight. He's got a double and a three-run homer.
I won't necessarily dwell on that because that's been an ongoing theme here, and I think people know where I stand on Vlad Jr. and just how good of a hitter he's become. But it's like, why are the Padres good? Why are the Braves good? I mean, to have one of these elite players like an Acuna or a Soto or a Tatis or a Guerrero Jr. puts you at a huge advantage. And then I think that they have some very good top-end talent. I think that the schedule will ease up. And I really do think that this team is more of a buyer than a seller. And I know that you could look at it both ways. And I'm sure there are scenarios where this team would sell at the deadline if they go into the tank and things go really in a wrong direction. But I think they're going to be buyers. And that gives them the chance to improve a roster that already is pretty good.
That would be wild. Could you imagine? Like, we're trading Marcus Semien, we're trading Robbie Ray.
Yeah, they would have some pieces, but it would have to be like a 10 and 25 run or, you know, something like that.
They'd have to go off a cliff for that to happen. Yeah, I'm not even entertaining that scenario right now. Like, there would have to be disaster of all disasters for that to happen. No, they need to supplement. Like, they need to add, and they need to get better. And like, the needs of this club are very clearly crystallizing. The bullpen being like first and foremost, I would say, the primary place where you need some help. And it's kind of funny to say that sitting here on Thursday, June 3rd, when on Wednesday, the bullpen was like miraculous coming in after Alec Manoah had a tough outing and left them with like 17 outs to cover. And then Charlie Montoyo deployed like this cavalcade of, you know, relievers who on paper aren't super impressive when you know, Joel Piamps and the guys that he was calling on, but they each came in and got the job done and pitched really well. Like Carl Edwards Jr., like coming out of nowhere, who's now on the Blue Jays and he's throwing 96. And the bullpen really stepped up and gave the Blue Jays what they needed in that game. But I would still argue that you need to help this group and you need to, like, at the very least, replace the season-long absences of Kirby Yates and David Phelps. And you need to go beyond that. So, like, I'm starting to kind of look around the league and thinking, oh, well, you know, Kendall Graveman in Seattle having a nice year, like Daniel Hudson in Washington, Ian Kennedy with Texas, Daniel Bard with the Rockies. Like, I'm starting to look around at, you know, some of those targets. And I'm wondering if the Blue Jays aren't even reaching out a bit earlier and maybe seeing if, you know, they can jump the market a little bit. Probably have to pay a little bit more of a premium to acquire somebody now when clubs know they can hold them until the deadline, when every team's going to be looking for veteran relievers like those guys and every team's going to be looking to supplement their bullpen. But I think the Blue Jays might need a little bit of help to get them through, like, you know, the next 6 weeks, 8 weeks until the trade deadline. I don't know that they can afford to wait until July 31 to make those moves.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You know, might as well go out there with respect to relievers. And I think the prices for relievers, they might be a little higher now. They should be a little higher now because you're getting more for what you're giving up. But even then, it's kind of easy to establish what the value should be. There's a lot of precedent for these types of moves. You know it's not going to be a top prospect. No GM is going to be out there asking for Jordan Groshans to get a B-plus reliever. So it's somewhat easy to establish what that value should be. And like you said, I mean, the Jays need help now and at a time that Thomas Hatch has had a setback and he is not close and Julian Merriweather is not close and Ryan Borucki is not close. And I know Tim Mayza has looked better of late, but man, was that ever a rough finish to the month of May for Mayza, where in the course of his 5 1/3 innings that closed out that month, he allowed 12 runs. I mean, of the 30 base runners or batters he faced, 12 of them came around to score. It was bad. And I don't know that you want to go into the heart of the season with Mayza as your main lefty. I mean, I think whether it's a lefty, whether it's a righty, Chatwood too, right? Like we've seen him really come back down to earth. So there was a clear need in this bullpen. And I agree that if you can go out there and do that now, it's hard for me to imagine the scenario that the Blue Jays really regret going out there and adding to their bullpen. Yes, you're going to have to give up something to get something, but that's happening either now or in July. It's hard to imagine that you're going to say, man, that was such a bad call on June the 8th, for argument's sake, to go help this bullpen.
Yeah, and there's going to be a price to be paid, obviously. You're probably going to have to give up like a prospect with some upside, unless you're trained for the big league roster, but it's hard to kind of see that. Like you look at that Rays deal where they get Fireson and Rasmussen, like they give up Willy Adames, who's like pre-arb shortstop, like a sound defender with like above average offensive tools for his position. That's valuable. That's a good piece. They gave up something to get something. So you're probably going to have to give up something if you're trying to get Daniel Hudson right now or Ian Kennedy. But I think the Blue Jays should do it. I mean, internally, what are your options? Patrick Murphy's on the way back, and I think that'll help. He's up to AAA now on his rehab assignment. And like everybody knows I'm a big Patrick Murphy fan. I love the stuff. And he's been up to 97 with the big breaking ball and in his rehab outing. So that's great. But like you mentioned, Ryan Borucki, like complete mystery about when he'll be throwing again. Julian Merriweather doesn't appear close to returning. So you can look kind of like just off the 40 man at some guys who have been performing well at AAA, like Connor Overton and like, Brian Baker and Kirby Snead. But if you're talking about, impact and you're talking about like replacing like a Yates and a Phelps, and you're talking about guys who are going to be pitching leverage spots in the 7th and 8th inning, hopefully trying to get the ball to Rafael Delis and Jordan Romano and try to ease up some of the workload those guys have had to carry and leverage. I don't know if I see that internally right now. So you kind of have to go outside the organization to get it.
Right. I mean, how many relievers can the Blue Jays really trust right now? I mean, they tried trusting Chatwood on Sunday and they tried to let him run with it and it totally backfired. He earned their trust for a while and now he's kind of unearned that trust. And yes, Charlie Montoyo should have had someone up behind him earlier. No question about that. That's on Montoyo. But also, as we move ahead from that, who can he trust? You've got Romano, you've got Dolis. Like, I think the list ends there when it comes to guys that you would want pitching and leverage. Like, am I missing someone, Arden? I think it's two. No,
it depends how you feel about Anthony Castro, I guess.
He's
starting to get nudged into leverage, but the guy's coming off of a forearm injury and he's got like, 10 big league appearances, great. He's having a fantastic season and it's great to see him doing it. But yeah, you're not talking about somebody with like an established track record. Like you're not talking about a veteran, like even a Chatwood who had done it for a month, 6 weeks even before things really turned pear-shaped for him lately. Like it's funny, I wonder if Chatwood would, if the Blue Jays were in a different situation, be a phantom IL guy, just with how he's looked recently and the trouble he's had commanding his pitches. Like the velocity still looks okay, and I haven't looked closely, but I imagine his spin rates are still fine, but he's not getting swing and miss and he's not commanding his pitches. And that's why like it was baffling that Charlie Montoyo didn't have somebody warming up behind him during that game on Sunday. Like I understand his options are limited. I understand the last time he took Tyler Chatwood out of a big spot, like Chatwood sat fuming in the dugout while Travis Bergen walked in 3 of his runs. But if you're worried about a guy looking over his like shoulder at somebody warming up in the bullpen behind him during a spot like that, if you're worried about how that's going to affect his psyche, like you got bigger problems. you got a bigger issue there. Like I think as a manager, you can't manage to that. As a manager, you got to win the game, and you got to know how Tyler Chatwood has looked over his last 2 weeks. It's not like he had one bad outing and it was like, oh, let's let him bounce back. It's been like the last five or six that he has been missing the zone, not getting swinging strikes. It's like 10 walks versus 2 strikeouts. I mean, to me, not having somebody up there was a serious, serious blunder by Charlie Montoyo.
It was. Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And it contributed to a loss in a game the Blue Jays should have won. That's on Montoyo. I think we both agree on that. And then, you know, it's interesting, right? Because you got the bullpen. And then I still think beyond the bullpen, there's a case to be made for improving this rotation, even though it probably looks better than it has for most of this season. Manoah has had one good start, one bad start. And Stripling has really come into his own in the last little bit as that number five starter. So you've kind of got five guys. But the reason I say they still should be out there looking to add to this rotation in the course of the next 8 weeks is because if you add someone and everyone's still healthy, great. You move Stripling to a long relief role. He helps you in that capacity. We were just talking about the bullpen, how it could use support. And let's be real here. Someone's probably going to get hurt in the course of the next 8 weeks. Or in the course of the next 8 weeks after that, in which case you can benefit from having Stripling in the five and the newcomer wherever else in the rotation.
Yeah, you feel okay about your starting depth at AAA right now, I think, when you consider like it's Nate Pearson and Anthony Kay. We'll see what's going on with Thomas Hatch. He's having this weird sort of side issue that set him back during his rehab assignment here, and he hasn't thrown in a little while. And, you know, that's a little concerning because the Blue Jays were like, hey, Thomas Hatch can be ready when, you know, his 60 days are up and he's going to impact us. We're stretching him out as a starter. And now it appears there's been a little bit of a setback there. So we got to kind of keep our eye on that.
And just to jump in there real quick, you know, it was described to me as minor, but we've also seen like Ryan Barucki fatigue and then all of a sudden he's out for a month. George Springer, it's minor. All of a sudden he misses half the season. So, I mean, yeah, you can't take the Blue Jays at their word for this. Not unique in Major League Baseball, but there's some subterfuge or obfuscation when it comes to the updates here.
No, yeah, we've talked about the skepticism that you have to have with, you know, team provided injury reports. So yeah, it's not just the Blue Jays, it's not just baseball, it's professional sports, right? Mm-hmm. It's 2021. It is what it is. You got to deal with it. But you can lump Julian Merriweather in there as well, right? As a guy who it was like, hey, he's not going to need much time once he's, you know, back throwing. And, you know, he could be like, once his 60 days are up, he could return. But we asked Charlie Montoyo the other day and it's like, nah, not close. So you feel fine about your starting depth, even, you know, all things considered. I'm not going to throw Hatch in there, but you think of Pearson, Kay, if you had to go to Zoik for a turn in the rotation, I mean, you could. He's been in the big leagues this year, and I don't know, he could five and dive, I think. So you feel good there, and maybe as the season continues, and if like Pearson gets back to the majors and is throwing well as a starter, and if Manoah, you know, we should talk about Manoah, I haven't gone there yet, continues to carry on as a starter in the big leagues, yeah, maybe there is a bit of trickle down there where it's like, okay, Ross Stripling moves to the bullpen, or like maybe there's a point later in the season where like one of Pearson or Manoah moves to the bullpen just because of how your rotation's lining up, maybe a trade deadline acquisition, things like that. So there can be some trickle down that can sort these things out. I just think that, you know, these next like 4, 6, 8 weeks before the trade deadline could do a lot for this Blue Jays season. You know what I mean? You got a soft schedule coming up. You got a lot of games without a lot of off days. It's going to be a point where they play like 18 and 19, I think. But you got a lot of like Baltimore Orioles coming up. You got the Tigers and the Twins come up. Like you've got the games that you need to win and you need to make hay on. We kind of talked about the margin for error with this division. Can't let too many more winnable games slip through, honestly. Like, and you don't want to like, you know, be too, you know, alarmist or anything about things like that. Like at this point in the season, we're only a third of the way through. A lot can happen, but just the way this division is playing out, Blue Jays need to win the games that they should win. And I think they're going to need some help to do that. Do you want to jump in on that or do you want to go to Manoah?
Well, I just want to jump in. As long as we're talking about additions here, I also think it's worth noting because pitching is the big one and there's no question about that. But you know, I still think that there's room to improve this position player core. And it's almost like counterintuitive because, of course, the biggest strength of this Blue Jays organization is its young position core. The biggest strength of the 21 team is its offense and its position players. At the same time, there's always room to improve. And there's no reason that you can't improve on a strength or a weakness within a strength, which is how I see the Blue Jays bench right now. And I'm looking back at that Wednesday game against the Marlins. And this is a situation where I would separate process and results because, you know, we talk about this all the time. Good process can lead to bad results. The opposite also holds true. So, you know, in the case of Reese McGuire stepping in there in the ninth inning in a situation the Blue Jays absolutely need base runners. And this is one that I'm not putting on Charlie Montoyo because, you know, ideally your second string catcher steps into the game in a situation in the ninth inning where you absolutely need base runners, you pinch hit. But Charlie Montoyo, his bench at that point, he looks over at John Schneider, looks at the lineup card. He's got Jonathan Davis, Santiago Espinal, and Danny Jansen on the bench. So none of those guys are hitters that you want up instead of Reese McGuire. So what do? You let McGuire hit. He came through to his credit, and that's the good result, despite the process that leaves the Blue Jays with a bench that really has no viable hitters on it. And so I know Kevin Biggio will come back at some point, so will George Springer. But I still think, in addition to that, you've got to be looking for ways to bolster this bench because, again, more injuries will happen, more guys will need breaks, and you don't want to be in a situation late in a game in 3 weeks' time or in 2 months' time where you look at that lineup card and those are your options. Like, it's not good enough. None of those guys are hitters that you want up. And sure, it'll work from time to time, as we saw on Wednesday. But I still think the bench offensively, even defensively, Espinal made a big mistake on Sunday. But, you know, that's an area this team should be looking to improve.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And that's another one where I'm not sure that internally that improvement is coming. You know, you can kind of, like you mentioned, right? Like Springer and Biggio hurt, obviously. If those, you know, they get healthy and you got everybody on hand, it looks a lot better. Yeah. When is everybody healthy? Someone's always going to be hurt. So then you kind of like look further down the 40 man. It's like, oh, well, you know, Otto Lopez is having like a strong year, a double A. Okay, maybe that's an option. Guy who's never hit above double A. Who knows what's going to happen in the big leagues, right? Like that's your impact, right? Like you don't know. Hopefully continues having the year that he's having, but it's possible he gets to the big leagues and looks like Santiago Espinal. You look at Gabby Moreno, right? Having a good year himself. The Blue Jays getting zero offensively from the catching position. By the way, which reminds me, Alejandro Kirk at some point will return to this team, we assume. Although details on him have been a little bit sketchy. That should help. But, you know, how long can the Blue Jays continue getting basically offensively zero from the catching position and having, you know, like you said, Reese McGuire in those big late game spots, a guy that the club DFA'd two months ago. So,
and yet he was their best option there. Like, it's crazy.
Right. So, again, outside the organization, I think they got to go. Everybody knows I want Eduardo Escobar in here as a Blue Jay at some point. But like, just it gets back to the fact that going into the trade deadline, like, I think the Blue Jays just have a lot of work to do. At least two relievers, if not three. At least one starter, if not two. And at least one position player. So there's like five moves right there that the Blue Jays have to make by the trade deadline, in my opinion.
No, I think that makes sense, right? I think you need like two relievers, one starter, one bench bat. That's your like B+ deadline. You know, that's like, this was a pretty solid deadline.
Let's kick Manoah to the second half and take the break. But when we return, we will sum up Alek Manoah's first two starts in the big leagues. Take a look around the roster as well as some players who are doing well, some players who are not doing well. Talk about when the Blue Jays might get back to Toronto. All that and so much more when we continue on At the Letters. It continues on At the Letters. Arden Zwelling, Ben Nicholson Smith, our producers Christian Ryan and Mike Tassoni, and it is time now for Keeping It Light, presented by Miller Lite. Very pleased to have a fan submission this week for Keeping It Light from listener Jason Teeple, who asks, "Hello, Ben and Arden. Who on the Blue Jays has a chance to make the All-Star game this year? Ben, aside from Vladimir Guerrero Jr., who has to be a lock at this point, who you got on your list?"
Yeah, Vladdy, absolutely. And again, want to see him in the Home Run Derby at Coors Field. Let's definitely make that happen if possible. So beyond that, I think Ryu belongs. I think that he should be an All-Star. And I mean, Semien belongs at this point. He should be an All-Star. And I think you've got maybe four players who could be in that mix. And I would throw Teoscar Hernandez and Randall Grichuk there. I think Bo Bichette has a shot. And Robbie Ray is pitching really well. So I think any one of those four guys could reasonably be an all-star. But Vladdy, Ryu, those guys should be there for sure.
Yeah, I think Ray is kind of the off-the-board guy who could go.
Yeah.
Jordan Romano, depending on what and the all-star selection is always so weird, right? Like how there's a lot that goes into that. But like Jordan Romano having a very nice season. You know,
yeah,
and like the numbers that people care about for all-star games are going to stand out for him in terms of like ERA and strikeouts and things like that. So that's another name that I would throw in the mix there. And it's kind of like wild that here we are 2 months into the season and George Springer is not a name that we are entering into this discussion. And the guy's had like, what, 17 plate appearances so far for the club? Like disaster start to the George Springer era in Toronto, and we'll see what happens from here on out. But you think about the fact that this team is paying him, like between his salary and the signing bonus, it's like over $30 million this year. I mean, $10 million, poof, gone. Yeah. No return. Two home runs, that's it. But nothing else. And then, like, you know, good vibes in the dugout. That's really all you got from it. As we sit here today, man, I have no idea when this dude is going to play. I have no clue. We hear, you know, from Charlie every day, like, oh, yeah, you needed some running. Yeah, he was in the outfield. It's going to take a rehab assignment. It's going to take the, you know, sprinting. Like, we're going to need to sort of start hearing those terms before I can expect him to return. Ben, like, it's June 3rd. When's this guy coming back?
I have no idea. I don't think anyone knows. I don't think Springer knows. It, you know, clearly, if the leg were responding, if the quad were responding the way they had hoped that it would, he would already be advancing through those stages. And he's not. So I think we can infer from that his quad is not responding the way that they would hope. And of course, you still have to be patient with it, as much as it sucks to be without your $150 million premium center fielder, leadoff hitter, a guy who is an elite offensive player when he's healthy. You've just got to be patient with it. And so, you know, to answer your question, I have no idea. And I truly don't think the Blue Jays know.
No clue. No clue. Nobody knows anything. Let's talk about Alek Manoah.
Because Alek Manoah's got to bear down, because here's Aaron Judge. And he got him. Look at that swing. How late Judge was. Might have been sitting slider. And Manoah strikes out Judge.
We said we would, and we must, because he's made two starts since we last recorded. One of them went pretty dang well against the New York Yankees. The other one scuffled a little bit against the Miami Marlins. You know, it's funny, like coming, if you were kind of predicting this coming into it, you said his first two outings are going to be at, you know, the first one's going to be his MLB debut in the Bronx, a Yankee Stadium against the New York Yankees. And his second one is going to be in Buffalo against the Miami Marlins. He probably would have expected, okay, maybe he'll struggle a little bit in the first outing, but then in the second outing, like he'll hit his stride. No, it's complete opposite. Can't predict baseball. It's a surprise always. But what do you kind of take away from, you know, the success he had his first time out, and then sort of the adversity he has faced his second?
Well, the first time you get a kind of proof of concept of, okay, he can step onto a major league mound, keep his composure enough to tap into stuff that is objectively very good, and hitters' reactions in that game, not the greatest Yankees lineup that we've ever seen, but it's still the Yankees. It's still Yankee Stadium. And those hitters' reactions told us that the fastball plays. That day, the changeup was playing. The slider wasn't so great in the debut, but still, it was a major league pitch. And so you know, and you can see from that one outing, that he can be a very good major league starting pitcher in a game that counts. And that's huge. That's a ceiling that not a lot of players have, and fewer players reach. And so to reach that for one game, his first major league game, is very encouraging. And then, of course, the second outing against the Marlins, he looked very vulnerable. I mean, he took that line drive off his body, allowed, I think it was all three home runs in that inning, all three off breaking pitches, off speed. You know, it's a learning process. I don't think we would have predicted, even as we were saying, that Manoah deserves a shot in the major leagues. No one would have predicted that it would be without bumps in the road. And so I still think there's a lot of reason to be intrigued by what he brings and what he can do next. But of course, it was never going to be a seamless process for him.
Yeah, it was an interesting contrast, right? Because in that first outing, against the Yankees. Like, it wasn't only the results, man. Like, the process was pretty sweet too. Like, yeah, he had a really good mix in that outing. He's playing like the four seamer and the two seamer off each other. Like, the slider was devastating, like you said, like the swings that we were seeing, you know, he's getting, you know, Aaron Judge is taking like awkward swings against him. He's got guys, you know, dropping to a knee, chasing the slider. I mean, he's painting with the fastball, and like, he threw the changeup way more than I think anybody was expecting in that outing. Like, this is supposed to be his worst pitch, and he was like executing a really good one. And the really cool thing was he started like half the hitters that he faced against the Yankees with a slider or changeup, you know, like he was giving them different looks. And he was earning, by the way, both swinging and called strikes with all four of the pitches. So like, he could do anything, right? Because he just had everything working. Like, he had everything in his arsenal. But so then that's the shift. And that was the change against Miami on Wednesday. Pitches weren't working, you know, like he was battling his command and he couldn't locate his slider. And yeah, after you know, he gave up the second homer on the changeup, like, he just stopped throwing it because clearly he didn't have confidence in the pitch, even though the two that he gave up, the second one to Aguilar, was like,
oh yeah,
well off the plate inside, and Aguilar just like drops his bat head on it and golfs it over the left field wall. But hey man, big league hitters are good. That's the kind of stuff that they can do, you know. After that third homer, just kind of saw Alek Manoah like a little hesitant, you know. And you even like, you look at the final plate appearance before Charlie comes and gets him, and he walks the bases loaded against Miami's number nine hitter throwing sliders in the 3-2 count. Not what you want to see. You want to see a fastball there. You're Alek freaking Manoah, man. You got a big fastball. Like, use your fastball. 3-2, you got a couple runners on. Might be your last hitter of the day. Like, don't be throwing a slider there. And he actually doubled up on his slider in that spot and missed badly on both of them. So, you know, to me, that suggests he did not have a lot of confidence in the stuff that he was pitching with there. But hey, man, when you take the mound in the big leagues every 5-6 days, sometimes you're not going to have your best stuff. And sometimes you're going to have to find a, you know, a way to get hitters out and to get outs for your team regardless of that. And the other thing I do want to like point out, Velo was down against Miami as well. Something worth keeping an eye on. It wasn't, you know, dramatic or anything, but it was like a mile and a half difference. So it'll be kind of interesting. Because the one thing I did notice in that, like, the one, if you could criticize anything about the Yankees start, was that he did not hold his velo that well over it. You know, in the first inning, it was like 96, 97. Look, first big league start, you got the adrenaline going, Yankee Stadium, all that. Then he kind of settled in at like 95, like second through fourth. But then by like the fifth, sixth inning, by the end of his outing, it was like down to like, you know, 92, 93, right? So you'd like to see him kind of managing his gas tank a bit better. And now clearly you'd like to see him like kind of managing things between outings a bit better so that he can actually be peaking on his start days. And I don't know if that's a between starts workload thing. I don't know if that's how much he's throwing. I don't know if it's physical. I don't know if he just didn't have it on this night or what it is, but like, these are the refinements. And this is like the development that needs to continue at the big league level for a guy who, oh, by the way, only has 11 professional games and just against Miami struggled in a professional game for the first time in his life. Like, that's how raw of an athlete we're talking about here. These are the developments that still need to continue to happen in the big leagues if Alek Manoah is going to be like a successful big league starter for a long time.
That's right. And it won't be the last time that he struggles. I mean, there will be more struggles. I think there'll be more games where his velo is a little higher and he can go out there against different lineups and maybe attack a little bit more, just have better command of the off-speed stuff, whatever the case. Maybe it's just a bit more batted ball luck or the wind is blowing in one day. These are the ebbs and flows that every major league starter encounters. And so still think lots of reasons to be encouraged, optimistic about what Manoah can do. It's interesting, you know, when I look ahead for Manoah, I think one of the things that stands out to me as far as managing him that's going to be really interesting is just how they manage his rest. Because in the course of his entire pro career, we're talking about someone who, when he first debuted in Vancouver, he pitched on 5 days rest every time. And previous to that, in college, obviously, the traditional setup is once a week. And then this year, he pitched on 5, 6, 7 days rest. So he's actually never pitched on your quote-unquote traditional 4 days rest. And that's something that will happen. The Blue Jays will put him in that position at some point this summer. But it's interesting to me to see how they manage that when they know that's upcoming, do they scale back his pitches, for example, in the preceding start? Is that something that they try to mix in, as we're saying, a Nate Pearson at some point or a bullpen day just to give everyone in that rotation a breather? Because yes, it'll happen, but that is something you want to be mindful of, if nothing else. It's not to say you baby the guy. He's in the major leagues for a reason. He is pushing himself to the physical extreme of his ability every time he takes the mound. So it's not like you're asking him to ease up, but you do want to be mindful of it.
Yeah, and that's going to be really interesting to watch play out, because you got to remember, like, the long-term ultimate goal here is that, like, he is logging 160, 170 innings, you know, in front of at the top rotation and, like, in a position where he can, yeah, pitch on 4 days rest, like, regularly, you know? Like, you want him to be that guy ultimately, and so, like, that, but, like, it takes time to kind of learn how to do that, and as you said, he doesn't have that much experience with it, so much goes into it in between outings as far as, like, you know, the feedback that you are getting objectively from, like, the strength tests that you're doing, like, your feedback subjectively, just how your arm feels and how you're recovering, you know, how much, like, yeah, recovery work you do, how much throwing you do in between starts, whether or not you throw a bullpen. Like, you learn a lot from Hyunjin Ryu about that, who's kind of, like, got it down to a science. Like, we know he likes that extra day of rest, certainly, but that's a guy who often skips bullpens, like, probably doesn't throw a between starts bullpen, like, more often than he does, just to manage his body and manage his arm. You know, he'll pretty much only go in there when he really does need to work on something. So, you know, that's part of, like, the learning process and the development process that's happening for Alek Manoah this year, while, oh, by the way, you're pitching in big league games that we need to win because we're trying to get into the postseason here. Like, it can be tough to manage and balance those two things, but it's going to be interesting to watch play out.
For sure. And the best teams in baseball are ones that do bring young players up and do find ways to bring them into that mix. You know, you think about the Dodgers, Urias or Gonsolin or May. These are things that they do all the time. And so it's a challenge the Jays need to be good at. And this is one example of many. We might see it next year with Simeon Woods Richardson, or we might see it later in the summer with Nate Pearson, of course, as they manage him. But this is a situation you want to be in if you're a good team, a good young team. And you just have to be mindful about it and have an approach that's not just reckless and tossing them out there whenever it's, you know, four turns through.
So the Blue Jays are back in Buffalo, Ben, at Salem Field. And we all got a good look at the renovations that have occurred there and, you know, the upgrades that have happened. The bullpen's moved off of the field and the Blue Jays, like, clubhouse and weight room and all of those kind of internal areas, like, look much improved from last year and obviously are much more lasting now. A lot of the renovations that have occurred, which is good news for future Buffalo Bisons and future AAA players in the Blue Jays organization. So that's good. And I think that right now, like, there's no Toronto Blue Jay who is upset about having made this move from Dunedin to Buffalo. It is certainly an upgrade. It's not where they want to be. They want to be in a big league ballpark. They want to be at Rogers Center. They want to be obviously playing in front of 50,000 fans, this, that, and the other. But they have at least, like, moved up from, like, kind of the back of the airplane, like the back of coach, up to kind of like that middle ground, like, economy plus kind of area, right? They're still looking up at first class being the big leagues, and they're not quite there yet, but they have moved up. They're not sitting next to the washroom at the back anymore. So that's a positive. But I guess the, you know, the natural question now is just how long are they going to be in economy plus? How long are they going to be in Buffalo? When might they get back to a big league ballpark? When might we see the Blue Jays at Rogers Center as vaccines continue to roll out and the pandemic continues to kind of develop and hopefully peter out a little bit here? Hearing Mark Shapiro talk about that, cover those topics this week, Ben, did it increase your optimism that the Blue Jays will be back in Toronto this year, or you know, how are you looking at it?
I wouldn't say that his comments increased my optimism. I'd say it held steady, because basically what Shapiro outlined was that, hey, the Blue Jays at this point would still have to cross the border, obviously, as would their opponents. And at this point, there is still a quarantine for arriving visitors to Canada from international countries. So that means you're looking at a 14-day quarantine. Major League schedule does not permit for that. So you need some sort of a workaround, some sort of an exception for that to be realistic. Now, since Shapiro spoke, and this news is still developing, but I saw news this morning that the federal government intends to grant an exemption for the Stanley Cup playoffs, where obviously either the Habs or the Jets will advance and be playing an American team, it sounds as though it will be permitted for the team that plays the Habs or the Jets to be crossing the border and to proceed as they would in a normal season. So that's a really important precedent for the Blue Jays to be keeping an eye on. And once that precedent is established and finalized, then that would be a starting point for them to work on and potentially build off of. And now playoffs are different than regular season. You know, hockey brings with it different logistics than baseball, certainly less volume. So, you know, we're talking about games every day in baseball. With hockey, we're talking about, is that a maximum of, I guess, 4+4 games? So it's a much smaller number, but it's still an important reference point and one that, for me, that hockey news actually does drive my optimism ahead.
I don't know that it drives my optimism though, Ben, because like I agree there should be a precedent set there, but I think it's like a playoff precedent and it's like a small window, few weeks, a month long maybe precedent. If we're talking about the Blue Jays coming to Toronto for, like, I don't know, all of August and all of September, that's a lot more, right? And that's a lot more coming and going from teams from other markets. And that's also, oh, by the way, and we don't talk about this enough, like a lot more time that you would be asking Toronto Blue Jays players to essentially be like prisoners to a stadium in a hotel and to not leave.
Most likely. We assume that, yeah.
Right. I mean, because, well, that's the last proposal that we saw last year. Yeah. Was like that sort of, you know, look, we're not going to like leave the Rogers Center. We're just going to stay at the attached hotel and all the visitors will do the same thing and we'll keep this little bubble. And that's part of the NHL proposal, or that's part of what's going to be happening with hockey. It's like you're going to be in a bubble and you're going to have daily testing and, you know, players aren't going to see their families. Like, think about being a Blue Jays player this year, man, and having to go through, you know, playing in Dunedin for 2 months. You've now already been, you know, you've already had the upheaval of now going to Buffalo and having to sort out your family through all that. Now you're going to ask guys to, like, for 6 weeks, 8 weeks, not see their families, or, you know, have their families come and live in the bubbles and not be able to leave. Like, I just think there's like so many complexities to this, even with like the visiting players. Right? Like, that's something, you know, the union would have to get involved in terms of
100%.
Like, right? And there would have to be some sort of agreement with the union and with the league and with all these stakeholders about how visiting players would be treated during all this. You know, any possible like legal ramifications for breaking a quarantine in a foreign country as a visiting player, you know, how would that would impact the rest of that player's season? I mean, there's just so many things to sort out here and so many complexities. Like, so I think if the Blue Jays reach the postseason, or if they get down to like the final homestand plus the postseason, yeah, you could like sort something out there because it's a shorter time frame and I think you could get better buy-in from everybody. But if we're talking about like the Blue Jays getting back for the final month, 2 months of the season, I don't know that my optimism has been raised by the NHL news.
Well, that's fair. I think it's a precedent that to me is relevant, but it's certainly not a direct comparable. And you're definitely right to say, I mean, you think back to, not these days, but think back to what it was like to try to get, say, 5 or 6 friends together and try to, you know, find a common time for a dinner or something. And then here it's like, oh, you have to find common ground with the Players Association, Major League Baseball, the City of Toronto, the Province of Ontario, and the federal Canadian government, all while respecting public health and the people of Toronto at a kind of baseline level. So it's complicated. And by no means would I say that my optimism is, you know, hey, they're coming back, like, you know, it's going to happen. But I think I can see a pathway there. And one way or another, there's going to have to be some administrative hurdles that the Blue Jays overcome whenever they come back to Toronto. And so maybe it could be this summer, but certainly wouldn't say that there's any assurances whatsoever.
And oh, hey, by the way, like, it's not like you just snap your fingers and you can just move your operation from Buffalo to Toronto. Like, as, you know, Mark Shapiro told us, like, that you would need like 3-4 weeks of lead time in order to get the ball rolling on doing that and on moving all this, the entire operation. It costs a ton of money. It's a ton of resources. Like, it takes a lot of time to sort out and you have to plan it very delicately. So like, there is even like a little bit of a ticking clock here, like a bit of rolling window occurring, and you can kind of just work backwards from the rest of the Blue Jays home schedule. So, you know, we'll see, man. Like, look, it, like, vaccines, like if the prevalence of vaccines and the effectiveness of vaccines continues and the variants can't, you know, don't infiltrate here and cause cases to spike back up, and all of a sudden the border is reopening and the 14-day quarantine rule is relaxed, that changes things big time. That's the biggest one. So watch the border and watch the quarantine rules, because I think that is like the biggest lever that can be pulled here. Otherwise, I'm kind of expecting Buffalo for like the foreseeable future and very possibly the rest of the season.
Right. And maybe there's a window, like even if that happens, maybe there's a window, again, using that Jets-Habs precedent, playoffs, shorter period of time. If the Jays are in, could they play their playoff games in Toronto? I mean, I think that's actually somewhat easy to imagine. But as we were talking about in the first half, you got to get to the playoffs first.
Yeah, the playoff precedent looks like it's going to be there. And that's easy when you're just dealing with one other club, right? And it's like, you know what their vaccination rates are. You know where they've been. Like, that's easier. When you're dealing with like multiple teams coming in and out throughout a home schedule, coming from different markets and having to have agreement with, you know, that many stakeholders, that gets challenging. So, yeah, I think definitely, like, if Blue Jays are in the postseason, I have optimism that that could be played in Toronto.
That would be awesome.
Got to get there. And Blue Jays right now, not in position to be a postseason team. But we'll see. Still 4 months to go in the season. Still plenty of Blue Jays baseball to play out. And still plenty of Athletics to come at you over the rest of the year. I want to thank our producers, Mike Tassoni and Christian Ryan. I want to thank Ben, as always. I'm not going to thank myself, but my name is Arden. And I want to thank you, the fans, for listening, interacting. Always appreciate it. Taking us out is a Hamilton band that released their debut album in 2014 and followed that up with a live record in 2019 with their latest single, Here's the Ruddy Ruckus with Hold On My Love.
When day after day turns to week after week and month after month turns to years, there's something that I have to get off my chest. I can't hold it back, oh my dear. If you'd like to meet in the middle, I'll keep you warm. And under the cover of blankets, we'll weather this storm. Hold on, my love. I know that your current direction is not enough. I don't know.